Okay, so like I said, more people are going to be coming on, but it's already 9 o'clock, so I'm going to start. I want to pick up with something that was mentioned last week before we move on about practices that are not in accord with the Shulchan Aruch. Someone mentioned that the Jewish Center has in their constitution that everything has to be in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch, and I gave you plenty of examples of individual practices which are not in accord with the Shulchan Aruch, and it was only after we had moved on that I thought of something, and I didn't want to go back, so I'll say it now, that since he mentioned the Jewish Center, I'll say every shul, I believe that pretty much, well, I won't say pretty much, as far as I know, every single modern Orthodox synagogue in the United States does something that is not in accord with the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm sure many of Haredi Minyanim also. So when you have for the Jewish Center or any other shul putting in their constitution, everything will be in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch. That's the problem I mentioned last week. What am I referring to? And this is why I'm glad we have Bill here. According to the Shulchan Aruch, I'll give you the siman so you can check. This is, I have the Mishnah Berurah here. It's 261, Reish Samach Aleph, Beis. The Shulchan Aruch explains Shabbos in accordance with Rabbeinu Tam's opinion. So what that means is not just that he thought it started a different time, it ends a different time according to him. Every single week when we end Shabbos, which is, I guess, some 45 minutes or so after sunset, we are now doing malacha, which is forbidden midiraisa according to the Shulchan Aruch. And not only according to Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah does not comment on the Shulchan Aruch, which means, I presume, that the Rama agrees with the Shulchan Aruch there. And so here's a perfect example. And not only that, most Rishonim also, as far as I know. So here we have a great example where, like I said, as far as I know, every modern Orthodox shul in the country violates the Shulchan Aruch on a weekly basis. And then Bill can tell me if I'm misunderstanding the Shulchan Aruch here, but I don't think so. With that in mind, let me tell you about something very interesting that happened to me this week. Okay, there you go. If I have the haskama from Bill, I'm an amateur. I'm a professional in certain areas, but in this area I'm an amateur, and I hesitate to tread where we have a real expert listening to us, but I was pretty sure that I could say that. And here we have, Bill says, absolutely overturn of the Vilna Gaon of Balatanya. Rama absolutely agreed, even more than the Mechaber. So here you have a perfect example, and there are other examples. But this is just one that all the examples I gave last week were individual examples, things we do as Yechidim. Here's an example where as a community, we violate the Shulchan Aruch, and, that's fine, but, we have to recognize it. But dealing with the Rabbeinu Tam business, according to Rabbeinu Tam, Shabbos starts later than when we started. It starts after sunset. This was, as Bill has written about, this was a common practice, in fact, even the dominant practice in most places in Europe until maybe 100 years ago. So my question was as follows. This is a question I've had for a while. I finally decided to do an experiment. The question is, let's say you're riding. You're coming back from New York City, coming home. Let's say you live in New Jersey where I live. And you left early enough, plenty of time, so it's not like you were careless or anything like that, and maybe there's a snowstorm or who knows, terrible, terrible traffic. They shut down the highway and you literally are stuck not moving for over an hour. And 2 hours, we've all had experiences like this. And it's clear that you're not going to get home by Shabbos, or you're going to the mountains. I remember going to the mountains with about a half hour left to Shabbos, and you'd see these Hasidim broken down the side of the road. So my question is, it was and it is, in such a situation, a Shas HaDachak, an emergency situation, can you say that, Shabbos will go this week like Rabbeinu Tam as an emergency? What are you going to do? You're 20 miles from home, 10 miles from home. You can't just leave your car on the side. I guess if you had to, you would, and you'd figure out something. I don't know exactly what. Someone I know actually did that, and the police came, and the police drove him to my town. But so the question is, can in an emergency situation, can you rely on Rabbeinu Tam and continue driving? Could be, I don't know, another 45 minutes even after sunset. So I, as an experiment, So Bill gives people 20, absolutely not more. Well, let me continue, and then at the end, tell me why not more. I'm wondering why not more, Bill, because according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's more than a half hour. You're talking, what are you talking? You're talking even close to 50 minutes. So you can write out your logic. But I emailed the three separate places I found online. There's about five or six of these places where you can send questions. Shiloh's in. You don't need local rabbis anymore. You send it to them, and one of them advertises posting at your fingertips. Just plug into the internet. Ask Halacha a question. And let me. And now this is my question. And I'll read you the question, and I'll read you the three answers. If I am driving in the car on Friday afternoon, there is a big backup, and I will not reach my destination by sunset, is it permitted to continue driving for a little while? I said only a little while. I guess that would be 20 minutes. After sunset, following Rabbeinu Tam's view and the Shulchan Aruch's position that Shabbos begins after sunset. Answer number one. The answers are 2 verses 1. I'll give you first the chumras. This comes from Eretz Chemda. One may not rely upon Rabbeinu Tam's opinion, as it is clear that his opinion is mistaken and contradictory to the astronomical reality as is known to us. This is what the Vilna Gaon clearly stated, and so is the common practice in almost all Jewish communities nowadays. It's interesting that he says in almost all Jewish communities. As far as I know, today, all Jewish communities, even the Hasidim, hold like Rabbeinu Tam, hold like the Gaonic position, although they're machmir to end Shabbos later. Although even that, again, Bill can correct me, I sort of think that our position today really can be called Rabbeinu Tam, because the Shulchan Aruch's position is not that you wait, at least I don't think so, you wait 50 minutes or 45 minutes after sunset. Now, Rabbeinu Tam is 72 minutes, but it's sort of, I would call it maybe a modified Rabbeinu Tam position that we do today. Second answer comes as follows. I ask the same question to another one of the internet sites. No, it is not permitted to rely on the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. And from the time of sunset, the sinking of the sun beneath the horizon, one must be stringent to consider the time as Shabbos. Many authorities follow the opinion of the Gaonim, at least the Chumrah, and in this case, where the question involved the Torah violation of Shabbos, even those who generally follow the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam will be stringent. So here are two who are telling me I have to leave the car on the side of the road, even in a Shas HaBachak, even on the highway, just stop the car. But then I have another answer. This is the answer, quote, there is certainly room to use the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam in times of great need, as in the case you describe. If there is no non-Jew who can take over the driving for you, or it is totally out of the question to leave the car and walk, then you may rely on Rabbeinu Tam and continue driving. However, you should make certain that you take Shabbat out according to Rabbeinu Tam also, so as not to contradict yourself on the same Shabbos. So here you have, I don't know what the answer is now, but I think it's interesting that you get different opinions on this question. Now, two of the halachic sites say that we have to, you have to absolutely start Shabbos no later than sunset, even if it's an emergency situation. And another opinion that says, no, that you can rely on Rabbeinu Tam, just make sure for that Shabbos you end like Rabbeinu Tam. So I guess in a situation like that, you have to find a posek and follow him. Yes, Bill says the Gaon and the Baal HaTanya say he's mistaken. Sure, they say he's mistaken. I just found it interesting that a modern person would say, he doesn't say that the Vilna Gaon has said based on the astronomy he's mistaken. He's saying that we know that the Rabbeinu Tam is mistaken. Usually, when dealing with Rishonim, you hedge yourself a little bit. No, it's interesting, Bill. The last site, the first site and the last site were religious Zionist sites. The middle site was the Haredi site. And if you could write, Bill, I'm just curious as to why you only give people 20 minutes after sunset. I'll let you write that while I share one more thing before we start. We had, at the end of last semester, I just wanted to get back to you about the Mechitza decision, the one before the Mount St. Clemens, and I have the information I can send everyone. It was a case in 1957 in New Orleans, where the courts ruled that you could not eliminate the mechitza because money had been given to a, quote, Orthodox synagogue, and that had legal implications. So I could send that information. Okay, now we have to return. We're just a few more minutes. Finish up with the Kassav Sofer. Just before we go on, Bill says that the view of the Rambam in Shas of Chak in New York area, that based on the Rambam, would only give 20 minutes. I'd be reluctant to go more because it's hard to know exactly when Shabbos starts, but okay, there you go. There's just a couple more responses that you vote I want to do before we move on to Ramosha Kunitz. In 1866, the Kassav Sofer was asked the following. When the priests, it's about a small town in Hungary, when the priests lead the procession with their icons at Easter, they demand that candles be lit in all the homes as they pass by in honor of the icons. And the problem was, this rabbi is writing to the Kassav Sofer, if the masses see that there's no candles lit in Jewish homes, they're going to get very angry and they're going to throw stones and break the windows. And it could even lead to a danger to life. Is it permitted for Jews, the Kassav Sofer is asked, to light candles in their homes? After all, it's not an action of Avodah Zarah. It's just putting a candle in your window to prevent you from your house from being attacked. Or is that an acknowledgement, in a sense, of Avodah Zarah? That's what he was asked. The Kassav Sofer quotes his father's response. I discuss this in a little more detail in my newest blog post that should be on later today. It was already supposed to be on today, but I'll explain it as well now. The Kassav Sofer quotes his father. His father, the Kassav Sofer, was asked the very same question. And the Chassam Sofer, we didn't discuss when we did the Chassam Sofer, but the Chassam Sofer says that even if there's a possible danger to life and limb and even life, you are not permitted to light such a candle. It's part of Avodah Zarah, idolatry. What you can do is you can say to your Christian neighbor, save me, which is a hint that the Christians should light candles in the Jews' home. In other words, the Kassav Sofer doesn't even allow saying before the Christian holiday that you should light it, but only if he says you can use it as a hint. The Kassav Sofer suggests that you should go to the government or even to the priest and say, under no circumstances are we going to light this candle. It is your responsibility to offer us protection from the mob. Now, let me talk a bit about the Chassam Sofer's tshuva, because it's really interesting. The Chassam Sofer was asked a question by a Hungarian rabbi about the priests who wander around with their candles and this marching for their idolatrous ceremony. And the Chassam Sofer answers it, and in his answer, the Chassam Sofer speaks about the candle lighting in Hodu, in India, the idolatrous candle lighting. I'll get the question gate on in a second. Anyone who reads the response of the Chassam Sofer, it's obvious that he's not speaking about India. India is a code word. You find this in the beginning of Sfarim all the time, that any time non-Jew is mentioned, it doesn't mean the non-Jews were living among, it means these idolaters living in places like India or China or things like that. India is things often used because India is the archetypal idolatry. The truth of the matter is, and I say this in the post that's going up today, Hinduism is not idolatry. Hinduism, it's not even shituf. Hinduism, from a Jewish religious standpoint, is preferable to Christianity. In Hinduism, all these gods are simply manifestations of the one God. But there is no incarnation. Christianity speaks of a man as God. And if that is shituf, if that is permissible for the non-Jews, then certainly Hinduism is. But Hinduism doesn't speak of an incarnation. Hinduism speaks of different gods. And what does it even mean, different gods? It's different forms of the same God. Hindus believe in one God, just different manifestations. But be that as it may, when the Chassam Sofer writes about this idolatrous ceremony in India, it's obvious code. As I said, after all, he's answering halacha l'maisa question of a rabbi in Hungary. And the Kassav Sofer doesn't even see the need to. I mean, he quotes his father, and he just talks about Christian society. He doesn't feel the need to even use the code word, I guess, feeling that there's not any danger in writing it. the Das Sofer, the Kiva Sofer deals with this question, the Priya Sada, that's Eliezer Deutsch. Everyone who deals with it, it's so obvious, it's not even an issue. And yet, there was a great, great posek named Rabbi Yehuda Asot, who lived a little bit later than the Chasam Sofer, not a student of the Chasam Sofer, lived at the same time and then later. A great Hungarian posek, probably after the Maharam Shik and the Kasav Sofer, the greatest of the Hungarian poskim in the mid-19th century. I can tell you that today, even the Hasidim hold of him. He was not a Hasid. I know this because when I was in Budapest in June, I believe it was. I was there twice last summer. In June, there were Hasidim there who had come to visit the grave of Mari Asad on his Yort site. And someone was telling me about this, and they were shocked because they gave out a little kuntres. And in the kuntres, they have a picture of Rabbi Yehuda Asod. In fact, I didn't realize, as those who are with me for a long time know, that probably 75% of what I say is extemporaneous. But if I remember, I'll do it for next week. If I knew I was going to speak about the Mari Asod, I would show you the picture now, which was in the kuntres. It's the only picture we have of the Mari Asod. And that picture was very controversial because that picture was taken after he was already dead. His eyes are open. So I'm assuming that they must have taped his eyes up because I don't think when you're dead that your eyes will stay open. And this created a huge controversy because can you imagine the people in the city after the Mari Asod is dead, before they bury him, they want a picture of him to hang on their walls. They dress him up in his garb and his I believe it's a Shrimal or a Marcus Sputnik, and they sit him up and they take a picture. And that is the picture of the Mari Asod. So the Mari Asod, the great author of the Yehuda Yahweh, he quotes this response of the Chasam Sofer, and he understands the Chasam Sofer to actually be referring to idolatrous candle lighting in India. And therefore he concludes, but our Christians we live among, they're not really of the Avodah Zarah. How a Gadol Shebegdolim could have ever come to this conclusion when it is so obvious? I mean, the Minchas Avodah, Chaim Lozer Shapiro, he's flabbergasted. He's dumbfounded. The only thing I can say is that maybe this wasn't written by by Asod. Maybe one of his students wrote it and he didn't really bother checking the sources. This is an unbelievable, unbelievable error. And there's other errors in the responsum as well. But to think that the Chasam Sofer, who's answering a halacha l'maisa question of a Hungarian rabbi, that somehow it's as if the Chasam Sofer is answering a question that some rabbi from Bombay is asking him, it's one of the strangest things you'll ever see, and I don't know what to make sense of it. What do we have here? Okay, let me go back to the question. Yidol asks, why isn't saying save me an Isser of Amir al-Akum? Look, if it's Bikuach Nefesh, the Kasav Sofer is saying, the Chasav Sofer is saying that that's not for Bikuach Nefesh. Already you have, the Shulchan Aruch speaks, Yidol, about we're not allowed to say, if you're not allowed to say, for example, I'm an idolater, even to save your life. However, you can say something that's has two different meanings. Or you can say something, you can imply something that's not really what you mean. Now, so as long as you don't do something or say something explicitly, I'm sure you could find a heter of your search to actually tell the non-Jew to light it. But if you're only hinting to him, it's already a few removed, you could see why you could find a heter for that. In a sense, it seems like it's a bit of a stringent decision, because after all, a stringent decision not to light the candle. If you look at the other sources, the Kasav Sofer and the others, they all go back to the Chasam Sofer. They don't really offer any independent analysis. Because at the end of the day, you're lighting a candle. So you can say you're lighting the candle. Maybe you could say light the candle, but sit next to it and use it to read. And therefore you could say the non-Jews assume you're lighting it for them, but you're really lighting it to get some benefit out of it. It would seem that you could, if you wanted to, you could find a way of permitting it. I can't help thinking that in the Chasam Sofer's mind, it really isn't Bikuach Nefesh. At the most, although he says, the issue is your rocks could be thrown and maybe it could lead to something. But if it was really an issue where if the non-Jews saw it, then they would immediately break down your door and start slaughtering your family, I find it hard to believe that he wouldn't have been able to permit this. But since it's, as it is, far-fetched, that it's going to be Bikuach Nefesh, at least that's my sense. Baruch asks, do all poskim agree with their classification of Hinduism as less problematic than Christianity? It's a good question. I don't think most poskim have a clue what Hinduism is. The only ones who do have a clue is the chief rabbinate of Israel that did a whole interfaith thing with Rav Shai Yashav Cohen and Professor Sperber, who knows a lot about Hinduism, having lived in India. And the chief rabbinate of Israel came out with an official statement, I linked to it in my post, saying that it is not idolatry. I know this all came up during the Shadal business, but if you look at Hinduism, maybe you could say that some of the masses, they don't understand and they're real idolaters, but the typical Hindu believes in one God. So if you believe in one God, and all you think is that there's manifestations of a different God, and you don't really believe in different gods, Christianity believes that they're really separate. Hinduism doesn't believe that. And Christianity has something, forget about the Trinity. People who listen to the show know that I don't think the Trinity is idolatrous. But what's idolatrous, and this is what all the Rishonim and Ashkenaz focused on, the philosophers focused on the Trinity. But the scholars of Ashkenaz, the Rishonim, they were not so into philosophy. For them, it was Avodah Zarah for one simple reason. They are saying that a human being is God. What's more Avodah Zarah than saying that? And that's, we call this the incarnation, that a human being is God. And Hinduism has nothing like that. So if you're going to say that Christianity is shituf, that Christianity is an acceptable belief for non-Jews, just not for Jews, because we have to have a pure idea about God, then kal vachomer, then certainly Hinduism is shituf. But I will go further. I would say that Hinduism, I don't even know why it's shituf. I think it's permissible belief for non-Jews. Not even shituf. Who says that a non-Jew is not allowed to believe that God manifests himself in different ways? But you're right. Most poskim, I think most poskim don't understand what Hinduism is all about. When they had this whole business with the Shadals, they had to call two people to find out things. One was Professor Nathan Katz in Florida, a Baal Tshuva. He even wrote a nice autobiography detailing, he used to be very interested into Eastern religions, and he wrote a biography detailing his move from Eastern religions to Orthodoxy. He lives in Miami, maybe some know him. And there was another person who actually, he was also in the news a lot, he was on the phone during the Mumbai massacre, talking to the terrorist. He is Melech Viswanath from Tinet. Maybe some know him. He's a convert, grew up Hindu, and I know people had asked him also. And he went to India and was there with Professor Sperber and has written about this. So, look, the Rambam says that it's important to study, and they used to study the writings of idolatry. He himself studied it because you need to know the writings of the idolaters to give halachic decisions properly, to understand for the Rambam, it was to understand certain Torah commands, which are responses to idolatry. And the truth of the matter is, the typical post-seg, not only does he know nothing about Hinduism, he doesn't know anything about Buddhism, he doesn't know about Taoism, he doesn't know any, so that's fine, they don't need to know about them. But before they start posking on shilas and costing people thousands of dollars to burn in their shadals, you would think it would be incumbent upon them to learn a little bit about what it is they're deciding. And some did. Some called up professors. When there was this controversy in Chicago in this early 70s or maybe 60s with the Mizrahi building being sold to the Buddhists, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik called up a big professor and discussed with him exactly what the doctrine of this particular Buddhist sect was, because this Buddhist sect is not the same as another Buddhist sect. And but I'm sure they do not. The other question was asked, hold on. Let's see. Which one's expressed? Okay, that's Baruch. So yes, it's the chief rabbinate of Israel. But even before the chief rabbinate said it, I said it. I actually had a conversation with this last summer. I was in Jerusalem and I spent an evening at Daniel Sperber's house. And he has an entire article he's coming out on the topic. And his argument is that you can't even refer to gods in Hinduism. I mean, if you just, we call them gods because that's the word that we put into English. But had people, when they first started translating from the Hindu languages, from Sanskrit and others into English, instead of gods, if they called them angels or something else, would we even consider it idolatry? Would anyone have ever concluded this? I mean, the word God, the way we think of it, doesn't really fit in the Hindu system. Bill says maybe he wanted to disagree and wanted to politically neuter the opinion of the Chassam Sofer. It's interesting you say that. I mean, we do find people saying strange things, like when they want to disagree and they want to be respectful, they say things like an erring student, a Talmud Torah wrote it, but I don't think so. Well, you'll take a look. I have the references. You can look at it. That's the basis of his decision. But it's interesting. Yisrael says, what about Yaakov Hillel? Okay, Yaakov Hillel, Yaakov Moshe Hillel is, for those who know the name, he's not a convert. He grew up Jewish. He's Iraqi. He went to the gates of Yeshiva. Now, he grew up as a typical, I guess you would call it, modern Orthodox type Jew in Bombay. And he was an artist. And then he went to England to university, if I recall. And then he went to Gateshead, and Rabbi Sassoon had a big influence on him. And now he's one of the great Mekubalim, Kabbalists. So you're right, they could have asked him the question, perhaps. Although, I'm not sure, because even the Jews living among the Hindus, I don't know how much they really learned about their religion or cared about their religion, but you're right. Yaakov Moshe Hillel, who founded Havas, I forgot what it's called, an institute in Jerusalem, published many Sfarim, a Kolel, he's the author of the Ava Shalom, thank you, he's the author of various books of Kabbalah, various books of response, including a book called Tamim Tia B. Tamim, I don't know how to translate it, which was translated into English, against all these Bubbas and these modern day Kabbalists who you go to read your palm and ask money for. I think in one of the books, in that book or somewhere else, he says that you know when someone's a real Kabbalist. A real Kabbalist doesn't ask you for money, and it's not like you pay him $500 and then he'll come up and tell you what you need. But yes, he is from India. Look, there were great rabbis in India. There were Gadol Yisrael or semi-Gadol Yisrael. I won't say first level, but there were some important rabbis who lived in India, and there was religious communities there. Okay, let us move on. Bubba, yes, I mean, correct, Baruch. I mean, the Bubba Salis and all these other ones. I don't mean Bubba as in redneck. Thank you. Moving on. Ksav Sofer Bubba. Yes, the Bubba Sali. The Ksav Sofer was asked if it is permitted to sell a scroll of the Torah to a convert from Christianity who still keeps kosher and goes to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The Ksav Sofer answers that if an apostate has a Sefer Torah, we're obligated to purchase it if we can, out of fear he may desecrate them. So how could you even have a thought that you could sell it to someone like this in the first place? He's never going to respect the Torah the way it should be respected. How much you have to spend, it's a good question. I was in Morocco when this guy wanted to sell me a Sefer Torah, an Ashkenazi Sefer Torah, a real Sefer Torah. I was looking for old books, and they bring out a real Sefer Torah. How they got it, I have no idea. I don't even remember what they wanted to charge me. I didn't buy it. I was certain I never would be able to get it out of the country. At the airport, they probably would think it's some cultural antiquity. When I was in Egypt many years ago, I was taken to a room in which there was about 25-30 Sifrei Torah, and there was, in Cairo, what do you have maybe now? Not even 100 Jews. The government wouldn't allow them to take it out. So, but I don't know, was I obligated to buy the Sefer Torah? Those who read the blogs recall that about a month ago, some Christian pastor of one of these black gospel churches was crowned a bishop or whatever they call it, using a Sefer Torah. They wrapped him around it. Who knows where they got the Sefer Torah from? Now, the Ksav Sofer does say that some authorities permit a Torah scroll to be purchased with money donated by a Meshulmid, but that's because the scroll will be kept in the shul, but it's forbidden to sell in the Torah. Two more questions before we end. One more question about marriage. Last week I spoke about having the marriage in the shul, and it had been a while since I seen the tshuva, so I looked back at it, and yes, the Ksav Sofer says the rabbi doesn't need to protest them having it in the shul, but he does say that the rabbi should not perform it, but if it's a question of darkei shalom, which means he's going to create problems with his community, perhaps be fired, that he's not sure about. It seems that he's leaning to let the rabbi do it, but he doesn't come down 100%. The other question he's asked is, what do you do if someone marries contrary to Jewish law? Should the rabbi turn to the government, and the government can declare the marriage null and void? Remember, these people were regarded as part of the Jewish community, and the Jewish community has to, in some ways, recognize the marriage. The problem was that the couple, they thought, would convert to Christianity to legalize the marriage. They're not going to live in sin. So I don't know what, he doesn't say exactly what the case is, if I recall. I prepared these many months ago. It might have been a Kohen and divorcee or something like that. The Ksav Sofer doesn't think we can ignore this issue. Because if there are children, especially if there are children, we can't be strict. Because if it's a second marriage with children and the parents convert and they're going to bring the children into Christianity, the Ksav Sofer feels better to be silent. After all, it's not our problem, man. Better to be silent. Well, before concluding with the Ksav Sofer, let me mention one response, an interesting response of the Shevet Sofer. We know that it goes this dynasty. You have Chasam Sofer, then you have the Ksav Sofer we're dealing with, and then the son Simcha Bunin. The Ksav Sofer dies fairly young. He wasn't even 60. He's succeeded by Simcha Bunin, the Shevet Sofer, succeeded by Rabbi Akiva Sofer. He's the last of the Sofers up until the Holocaust, known as the Da'at Sofer. As Bill mentioned last week, he reminded me that Yaakov Katz in his autobiography, who studied in Pressburg with Akiva Sofer, recalls that some people refer to him as the Taos Sofer, the ones who didn't like him. Taos Sofer means a mistake of the scribe. And Katz does not have such complimentary things to say about him. Basically, he says that he wasn't such a great Torah scholar. He's just, as was often in yeshivas, he inherited the position. The Shevet Sofer was asked a question which comes up every year, and today, and Rav Avad Yosef and others have spoken about it. Is it proper for people to go visit the court of the tzaddik on the festival, leaving the wife and children at home? To be a chassid, and it's not like today, where you get on a plane and you go, and let's say you're in Los Angeles, and you're a munkacher, and you want to come to the Rebbe for the holidays, so you leave your wife and children, you take one of the two of the boys, and you're on the plane, so you're not there for the chag itself, but you're back relatively quickly. That itself is problematic, because holidays are supposed to be spent with the family. But in the Hasidic world, you would leave the family, and you'd go to the Rebbe. This is a sign, incidentally, that the position of women in the Hasidic world declined. Because, at least with the Misnagdim, they stayed with the wives. But when you had the Hasidim, and they would travel, and they traveled by carriage, it could take 2 or 3 days, leaving the wife at home for the holidays, I would say that that's an example of how the position of women in Hasidus declined. Today, the issue isn't so much the way it comes out most often, I mentioned Rav Avad Yosef and others, is because going to Uman, the shul in Uman was just finished, I'm told, which I believe makes it the largest shul in Europe, larger than the Dohani shul in Budapest. Every year, Rosh Hashanah, they don't go the other holidays as far as I know, but Rosh Hashanah, I guess Yom Kippur also, but Rosh Hashanah, you have thousands and thousands, and not just Hasidim, Sfardim, and all sorts of types. They leave Israel or other places, and they go spend the Chag there. So Rav Avad Yosef and others have spoken out against this. But so the Shevet Sofer is asked this question, and here is something where you would expect a non-Hasidic Rav, as the Shevet Sofer, to say, of course you don't leave your family. Yidel says today it only happens only in Breslov. That's interesting. Why would it not happen in Munkach? If there's no Inyan, there's no concept that you want to spend it with the Rebbe? In Europe, it always happened. In Europe, they would leave to spend it. So please enlighten us. Why, if this is the same Yidel, I think it is, he's speaking with knowledge from the inside. So it'll be interesting to know what the change would be. Baruch says, most probably with Breslov, because who lives near Uman year-round? And Baruch says it does happen among other groups. No, Uman, because also Uman is special. the Rav Nachman spoke about how important it was coming to the grave. But in Europe, they used to go to they used to go for the holidays to the various Hasidic rebbes. Not everyone. In Uman, I'm told there are some women who will come, but basically they don't. So Yidol's saying that today you could take your family along, so they don't need to be like in the past. Okay, so they come, but I'm sure there's still people who leave the wife at home. If you have lots of children and it's expensive, but it's not the same as it used to be. The Shevet Shofar defends the practice, which I think is significant. So we see that there's an acceptance of Hasidism, at least a Hasidic practice, which I find it hard to believe that his father or grandfather would have written this way. Baruch tells us that those are Hasidim go to be with the Rebbe. Look at Misnagdim must sometimes leave and go away to be at the yeshiva. It's not unheard of for non-Hasidim to leave and go to the yeshiva for Rosh Hashanah. And sometimes taking the wife, other times not taking the wife. Kavachomer with the Hasidim. Okay, we are now moving on to the next figure. Let me pull him up. Figure who, if I can be frank, I'll say that I don't know if many of you have heard of him, Rav Moshe Kunitz. He's not a major figure. He is interesting and worth discussing, especially as it leads to other things, other areas that we've dealt with. And the truth is, the reason I prepare talks about him is because last summer, and when we were in Budapest, I had to speak about him. We went to his grave, and he was a significant figure there. He was a Dayan. And I'll speak about him again this summer, God willing. And since I was going to speak about him then, I figured why not put him in. So we'll spend maybe a class and a half on him before we move on to the Meshach Chachma, the Ar Sameach, Rameir Simcha of Divinsk. He's in this world of the Chasam Sofer and the Ksav Sofer. We're going to continue among this world. We're going to do the Maram Shik. We're going to do all these figures, but we'll keep going. So let's talk about who this Rav Moshe Kunitz is. There's three pictures I know of. This picture, another picture that was recently published, and then I'm going to be putting on not the post that's coming up today, but the next post, probably in another week or so, a picture of which I discovered of Rav Moshe Kunitz, which has never appeared in print. No one knows about this. Who was he? Well, first of all, he's a very unusual fellow. He's born in Abuda, which is north Budapest. And I said last week, I forgot whether what year Budapest becomes Budapest. It's 1873. Before that, you had three cities. You had Buda, which is on the west side of the Danube. You have Pest, which is on the east. And in the north, you have a place called Abuda. He was born in Abuda. Abuda, in Jewish sources, is known as, you see this on the front page of Hebrew text, because they're publishing, they publish books there, Alt-Offen. And this is Alt-Offen, Old-Offen, Old-Buda. And this is where he spent his life, in Budapest. It wasn't called Budapest then, it was Buda and Pest. He was descended on his father's, so he has great yichus. He's descended on his father's side from a Gershon Ashkenazi. Gershon Ashkenazi was a Rav of Nikolsburg. He succeeded his father-in-law, Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmo. Those who come with us this summer back to Europe, we go to Nikolsburg and we go to the grave of Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmo. Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmo offered an important sefer known as the Tzemach Tzedek. So when you speak about the Tzemach Tzedek, the volume of responsa, you have to be careful if you speak about the Tzemach Tzedek of Lubavitch, who's also Menachem Mendel, or are you speaking about the earlier Tzemach Tzedek, Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmo. I always assumed that Rav Nachman Krochmal is related some way to Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmal, although as far as I know, this is not documented anywhere. I'm assuming it's all one family, but I could be wrong on that. Because as far as I know, Menachem Mendel Krochmal never mentions this. He only served as Rav, that is Ashkenazi, for 3 years in Nikolsburg. Nikolsburg today known as Mikolov in the Czech Republic. He then goes to Vienna. The Jews are soon expelled from Vienna, so he goes to Metz, the important Jewish city of Metz. where he remains there until he dies in 1693. One of his students, by the way, was Rav David Oppenheim, who becomes important Rav of Prague. Another one of his students was the Maharam Padua, or Mayor Katzenellenbogen. We will speak about him this summer on our trip to Italy, although we will not go to his grave. The trip to Italy, much less graves. We only go to one cemetery. That's because we're not going to Padua. I wish we had just one more day to go to Padua, because in addition to the Maharam Padua, Abarbanel's buried there, and also Shadal, the great Shmuel David Lazzato. But that'll be another trip, God willing. On his mother's side, he also had great yichus. He was descended from Rabbi Yair Chaim Bacharach, the Chavos Yair. Who did he study with? Well, in Buda, he studied with Rav Wolf Boscovitz. Wolf Boscovitz is the author of the Seder Mishnah, very important work on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. He had been living there since 1790, and in 1793, he's elected Rav of Pesht. He ends up leaving, that is, Rav Wolf Boscovitz. There was another great Rav in Budapest, in Buda, named the Maharam Mintz, or Moshe Muntz. The problem with Rav Wolf Boscovitz, the Seder Mishnah, was that his rabbinical contract said that the Maharam Mintz had authority over him, and they had much machlokas, many difficulties. Both of them were great gedolim, great Torah sages, scholars, and yet they had terrible machlokas. And I'll just mention it, we dealt with Shitov a few minutes ago, the Seder Mishnah, whose works, by the way, were not printed in his lifetime. They were printed later. Maybe one was printed, but only recently were some printed. He is famous for defending the viewpoint that non-Jews are not obligated in Shitov. That is, this old dispute, which goes back to how to understand the Tosos, where Tosos says that non-Jews are not obligated in, I guess, associationism, associating God with another God, with another entity, which in context doesn't seem to be a theological statement. It just seems to be that when, if they make an oath, that is, if you have a business problem with a non-Jew and you go to court and he's forced to take an oath and he takes an oath on Jesus, let's say, that's not a problem in the context of an oath. But it doesn't necessarily mean that he can believe this, that it's an okay theological doctrine. The Noda B'Yehuda, not the Noda B'Yehuda in the response to Noda B'Yehuda, but written by the Noda B'Yehuda's son, Rav Shmuel Landau, he has a long response them against this and saying that's not what they meant, that that non-Jews are also obligated in Shituf, that a non-Jew can't believe in Jesus or anything like that. It's a violation of the Noahide Code. And that's the Rambam's position and others. However, the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, agrees with the understanding that it means that non-Jews theologically are not obligated to have this pure view of God. I had a debate with David Berger over the Chabad movement, how to respond to them. And in that debate, we discussed an issue, and he said something very interesting, that he didn't think that there's any problem. Even if as an academic, from an intellectual standpoint, you believe that the interpretation of the Rama and others of Tosfos, that Tosfos is saying that non-Jews are not obligated to believe in one God, that they can believe in a God divided into parts. Even if you think that's not what Tosfos meant when you're in your academic suit, nevertheless, since the Rama, post-Sheik of Ashkenazic Jewry, did think that that's what they meant, there's nothing wrong with saying, halacha l'maisa, we follow the Rama, even though I think the Rama is wrong. Not even though I think, even though I know the Rama is wrong, in my opinion, there's nothing wrong practically following him. And we've discussed this issue before. But the Rama, Wolf Boscovitz, he is a strong defender of the Rama's position. Now, when I say that he's a student of Wolf Boscovitz, where every biography you look at will say that Kunitz is a student of Wolf Boscovitz. And he was a student. But if you do the math, you see that he was a student of him from the age of 10 to 13. That is, that as a young man, before Bar Mitzvah, he would go as the Rav, Wolf Boscovitz would give shirim to the students. And he would go. Today, I think if you told someone just think of in our day and age, think of a great Rosh Yeshiva, think of Rav Soloveitchik or Aaron Cutler. And if someone, and if I say that Rabbi X is a student of Rav Soloveitchik, and then I say yes, when he was 10, 11 years old, he was a student, people would think I'm crazy. You can't be a student at 10, 11, 12 years old. A student means, doesn't even mean in college, perhaps. It means post-college. It means certainly in the 20s. That's what it means. And yet, when you think of the olden days, when you think about in years past, and you look at the ages of when some of these people were in yeshivas, when some of these people with these, we know they were, some of these great rabbis were married at 16, and we speak about that they were talmidim, they were students at a much younger age. It's important to remember what we today might not really regard them as students in the same way, we might say that they came to listen to Shiurim, but regard them as students, but they regard themselves as students. And we have plenty of examples of people who studied under big rabbanim when they were children, and they regard themselves as students. At the age of 14, he leaves his home and he goes to Prague, again, to study under the noted Yehuda. But he's 14 years old, and he is a student of the Note of Yehuda. Things were younger then. If people are getting married at 17 and 18, and then getting off and becoming rabbis, plenty of these people became rabbis at 17 and 18 years old. Their entire schooling, their formal schooling, takes place between. When you get to the 19th century, the ages are older. But if you're dealing with the 17th century, 16th century, people are getting married very young and becoming rabbis of the communities at 18 years old, and they go to a few different yeshivas. So if you do the math, you see that from age like 11 to 12 or 13, they're in with one great rabbi. Then from 13 to 15, they're with another one. When our children are still in high school or even elementary school, these were talmidim. Yes, why? I can't offhand. I mean, pretty much all the ones I think about. But if you email me or remind me, I'll give you some good examples for next week. I mean, I'm thinking all these great rabbis who we know are married at like 17 years old, 18 years old. But I don't want to chance it and give names of people now without being 100% sure. But just drop me an email and I'll try to come up with some good examples for next class. But as I said, it all comes down to when you look at who was getting married. You look at in all the biographies of these rabbis, they tell you how old they were when they get married. And then they went off, and even Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, Talmud Mufak of the Altar of Sobotka, he was gone from Sobotka by 17 years old. He was gone from Sobotka. Let's see, 1884... I think by 17 years old, he's pretty much gone from Sobotka. And yet he's regarded as, this great, great student of his. And most of his connection to the altar happened before 17 years old. Now 17 is still, 16, 17 is a little older, but you have examples, you have other examples. I'll try to come up with some good ones for next week. Other than we just have Moshe Kunitz. I think the Note of Yehuda also, if I'm not mistaken. Look at the Note of Yehuda. I'll come up with some good ones. While in Prague, he doesn't just study with Note of Yehuda, though. He becomes influenced. He comes under the influence of another important figure in Prague at the time. There were great figures. There was Rabbanim and others. But the one I'm referring to, his name was Baruch Yaitelis, spelled with a J. J-E-I-T-E-L-E-S. Buried, incidentally, right next to the Note of Yehuda. I mean, maybe about 50 feet away. He also had a yeshiva, but he was a maskil. When I say a maskil, I think today I'd call him a modern Orthodox rabbi, or even like a German Orthodox rabbi. This is someone, a great, great Talmud Chacham. He has I have it in the room I'm in right now. Can maybe reach over and grab it. I'm afraid, though, I might pull out my speaker here. I'm looking to see if I have the sefer. He wrote an important commentary on a work on the Mishnah Torah, a very great Talmud Chacham, Baruch Yaitelis. His father, Jonas, was a doctor. Baruch Yaitelis, though, was a very open-minded, open secular studies. Incidentally, he dies. He opened up a prison
for soldiers, not a prison, a hospital for soldiers. And he worked with the soldiers himself, and he caught a hospital fever, and he died. But he had his issues with the Note of Yehuda, but a great Talmud Chacham, and he influenced Kunitz. After 2 years, Kunitz goes to Breslau. And this is a pattern which you see among other great rabbis of this time, where they would travel from city to city. You know, the yeshiva would start when they were like 11, 12 years old. They would travel from city to city and until they would get married. You know, when I mentioned before, this goes back to Yidol, what your question, there were many Rabbanim who started, great Gedolim in those days, who started yeshiva at early age. Now, some of them can really be said to be Talmidim in the sense we think of, because maybe from the age of 12 to 19 or 18, they were in the yeshiva. But like I said, other times they just left the yeshivas. And even into the 19th century, the Meshiter, Roshoma Palachek, if I'm not mistaken, at 12 years old, he came to Brisk, and that was very unusual. They usually didn't, not Brisk, he came to Volozhin. Volozhin did not let people in unless they were older. Baranovich, I should actually say that, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, here's a perfect example of this. How many people have claimed that they were Talmidim of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman? And many have. I can give you a list. I think who's the rabbi in Washington Heights? I forget his name. And there's a number of people who, Rabbi Baron from Montreal, the students of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Baranovich was not a real yeshiva. Baranovich was like a high school. You went to Baranovich, and it was very Hasidic, incidentally, but you went to Baranovich in your, maybe as a young teenager, and then you graduated from Baranovich and went to one of the great yeshivas. So all the people who are, quote, Talmidim of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, they're Talmidim in the age that our children are the early years of high school or late elementary school, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, maybe 10th grade. And then they move on to the other yeshivas. Bill says, you are right. The joke is Rabbi Chaim asking the Tziv if he brought his crib. Oh, you talk about the Meshiter. Yeah, the Rabbi Palachek. No, the yeshiva is a Hasidic yeshiva. It was half Hasidic, the Baranovich yeshiva. They even, on Nittel, what's his name? He lives in Washington Heights. I forget his name. He told me that in the Baranovich yeshiva on Nittel, they didn't learn. And I was shocked. A Lipish yeshiva, and he told me there was lots of Hasidim in the Baranovich yeshiva. And I just saw David Katz published a nice big like coffee table book about Lithuanian Jewish life. And he has a chart there, a map of all the yeshivas. And he has the yeshivas, those yeshivas which are Misnagdim, those which are both. And he has Baranovich as half green, half red, that is half Litvish, half Hasidish. The first I ever heard that there was a strong Hasidish element was from this rabbi from Ashton Heights, whose name escapes me now, who told me about how, and the reason I called him was because I'd heard from someone else. If I'm not mistaken, the person I heard it from was the professor at Hebrew Union College, again, whose name escapes me, I'm getting old. He was a student of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman also. He told me originally, and I confirmed this, that in Baranovich on Nittel, they didn't study Torah. So that's what my basis for saying yes. That's the basis where I'm saying that you have, that the yeshiva itself had many Hasidim in it. So you say the Swanim Rebbe was in Baranovich. Sure, there was Misnagdim there. 100%. And Rabbi Chanan was a Misnagdim. And there were plenty of Misnagdim in the yeshiva. But the yeshiva also had Hasidim. And it was a significant element in the yeshiva. That's what I was told. I'm talking about the demographics of the student body. I'm not talking about this. I'm not talking about the town. I'm talking about what I was told by an attendee of the yeshiva, that the yeshiva itself had a significant number of Hasidim, and that explained why many people there did not learn on Nittel. If the answer is differently, please send me the information. As I said, this was all news to me, that in the yeshiva you had such a Hasidic element, but that's what I was told. And as I said, just ironically, last week, I see in David Katz's book, he says the yeshiva itself was, he categorizes it as half and half. There's some yeshivas in Lithuania which were real Hasidic yeshivas, but he categorizes it as half and half, half Hasidish, half Misnagdish. So perhaps it needs a little more investigation. No, I didn't say it was a Hasidish yeshiva. I didn't say it was a yeshiva at all, Hasidish yeshiva at all. How could it be a Hasidish yeshiva with Rav Chanan Wasserman? But if half the student body, let's say, is Hasidish, to call it a semi-Hasidish yeshiva in that sense, not in this, it did not function as a Hasidish yeshiva, in that there was no, it was a traditional Lipnitz yeshiva in terms of learning. So if anyone understood me to be saying that it functioned as a Hasidish yeshiva with a Rebbe or anything like that, not at all. It was a Lithuanian yeshiva, but the student body, and according to what I'm told, it influenced the culture of the yeshiva as well. And you point out that Sabbatha, you have that, you even have in Panapaj, you have in Lakewood. In Lakewood, you have Hasidim, although Sabbatha, I know, you have Hungarian Hasidim who go there, etc. Yidol says, if they didn't say Torah Nittel, they can be called Hasidic. Yes, now I was told that the yeshiva itself, the whole yeshiva, when I say the whole yeshiva, obviously individuals can do what they want, but I was told that, this was his memory, that in the Beis Medrash people were not learning on Nittel. So, take it for what it's worth. The stipler, who was not a Hasid at all, he also did not learn on Nittel because he didn't want to offend the Hasidim. So maybe the majority Misnagdim didn't want to offend the Hasidim, and they said, okay, you don't need to learn. So he moves on to Breslau. A few more minutes. Who is the Rav of Breslau? Kunitz moves on to Breslau, and the Rav is Isaiah Berlin. Kick. Well, let me move back a minute, because I see there's a conversation going on here. Yes, we had classes on the Stipler. We spoke about the Stipler's background and everything, but although he came out of a Hasidish background, I think you have to acknowledge that he converted to Misnagdish life, and in the Archos Rabbeinu, in which they discuss why he didn't learn on Nittel, they make it very clear that it was only because of he didn't want the Hasidim to be upset. I guess the proof would be, did he wear a gartel? And I've never heard anyone say that he wore a gartel, but maybe he did wear a gartel. But I don't know. That's in the book, the 5-volume series on it. It talks about the reason he didn't learn on Christmas Eve was not to offend the Hasidim. And wearing a gartel is no proof either. Do you know that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky wore a gartel for many, many years? Because when he came to Toronto, I know we have people here from Toronto, so let me tell the story. He came to Toronto, he became rabbi in a Hasidish little shul, and one of the members of the shul gave him a gartel. So Rav Yaakov wore the gartel. He didn't want to offend the person. He wore the gartel. I was told this by Rav Nachum Kamenetsky. He wore the gartel well into the 1960s. And so you're talking, was it 40 years or 35, 30 years, until the gartel became really worn out, and then he got rid of it, and he didn't replace it. Okay, so many interesting comments here. Who is the Rav of Breslau? Rav Isaiah Pick. Breslau later becomes famous as the seat of Zachariah Frankel and Heinrich Rest, but there was a great Rav named Isaiah Berlin Pick. You have his notes in the Gemara, and an important figure. Kunitz learned under him. He also studied at the university there, and there was a Maskil grammarian named Yehulei Ben Zev. He came under his influence as well. In Breslau, he publishes his first book. It's called Mostar Tevel. It's a commentary on Talmudic Agadah. He wrote it when he was 20 years old. In 1796, by the way, before we go further, Kunitz was very interested in Agadah because he had these Haskalah tendencies. He had been influenced, and many of the Maskilim really had contempt for Agadah. They saw Agadah as nonsense and foolishness, and they liked to cite people like Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam, who they said didn't really pay attention to Agadah. I think we can say today that they didn't really appreciate Agadah. They didn't understand it. They just saw it as a whole bunch of nonsense. And when I say appreciate it, I don't mean appreciate it in the sense of the Rambam, that you have to look in the inner meaning of it. I mean appreciate it even from, even if you don't want to buy into it, but see it as a culture, as being of cultural significance, just like they had no sympathy and understanding for what Hasidut was. They just saw it as a bunch of superstition, or Kabbalah. Jewish historiography was poisoned for, I guess you could say, even almost 100 years, 80 years, against Kabbalah because of the Maskilim, because of people like Gretz, who simply saw it as nonsense. It really, until Gershom Scholem, I should say there are people before Scholem, but Scholem really gets a lot of credit, to see this as a real discipline, as a sign of Jewish creativity. You could say the same thing about the Agadah. So as someone who's influenced by Maskilim and has one foot in the Haskalah door, it was important for him to show the great wisdom and the significance of Agadah. For a traditional Rav, you don't have this challenge. People who you are friendly with are not challenging Agadah, not speaking of it as nonsense, and therefore you don't need to relate to it this way. People like Kunitz need to show the significance of Agadah. We see the same thing among other religious Maskilim, and we see the same thing in Germany. The Torim Derech Eretz type of rabbis, they also need to approach Agadah a certain way to show, because look, they're not going to take it literally. So if you don't take it literally, does that mean that it's all nonsense and you throw it out? No. You have to then explain it and show why it's significant and what Chazal have in mind. So I see we're already out of time. We still have some good stuff left to do with Rav Moshe Kunitz. We'll deal with him and Rav Yaakov Emden. Deal with Kabbalah. We'll deal with some of his halachic, at least one of his halachic viewpoints, and his volume of Tshuvot, one of the most unusual volumes, two volumes actually, two halachim of Shelot and Tshuvot ever written, is written by Rav Moshe Kunitz. So that's all for next week, to be continued. Thank you very much again for all the comments. I'll wait on for another minute or so if anyone has comments. If there are things you want to say, you don't want to say it here, as always, just email me and I can deal with it next week if it requires that. But I'll stay on for another minute. Yisrael asks, when they let 12-year-olds into these yeshivos, was it based on their potential or were they already on a par with the typical Talmud there? In the great yeshivas, Sabbat Gamir, they didn't let 12-year-olds in as a general rule. There could be exceptions. There were other yeshivas, smaller yeshivas, and 12-year-olds were definitely welcome, and many of these cities had small yeshivas, little batei midrash. And in earlier years, they didn't have the great yeshivas. What you had was people who gathered around a rav in different cities. I mean, there were some yeshivas, but for the most part, people learned in small, little yeshivas with rabbanim, and they didn't let them in if they didn't know anything, but basically everyone knew something, because who was going to yeshiva? It's not like today, where everyone after 8th grade graduates into high school. An entire village, entire town, you might have one or two people who go, the rabbi's son and maybe one rich person's son who goes to yeshiva. Yeshiva was not a mass movement. By age of 12, 99% of the boys were apprenticing for a job. So the only people who went to yeshivas were the elites of the elite. I've said it, Yisrael, many times, that this idea that everyone learns Daf Yomi now. No one learned Daf Yomi. No one learned Gemara. The masses learned, they had maybe Chevra, they did Tehillim. And then the people who knew a little bit more from Cheder, maybe they had a Chevra in Yaakov, and maybe a little Mishnayos. The only people who went, if the Rav gave a little Gemara shiur, were the few Talmid HaChachamim. Yeshivas were for the elites of the elites. And therefore, if someone is going to yeshiva, he's going to a lower type yeshiva, like Baranovich, at 12 years old or something, he already knows how to learn. He's been taught, he's had tutors, his father had learned with him. So we're dealing with the elites. And yes, the Mecheter, who comes to the yeshiva in Volozhin, a place which did not take students at that young. In those days also, they weren't getting married so young. The students started getting married later. The Mecheter was of the level. I mean, he was a genius of a genius and one of the great students of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. We dealt with his biography so many times, spoken about how his early death is what leads Rav Moshe Soloveitchik to America, and then following Rav Yosef Dov, how he dies of a simple gum disease, gum problem that today antibiotics could have cured. I spoke about how the famous comment coming and seeing the boys playing sports saying, why couldn't they have let us do this? You know, we would have had, we we would have been the same Lamdanim, but we would have had a childhood. And this great student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, of whom you can read a little biography, was written by Nelson Kamenetsky in the book published by Yeshiva University a few years ago. He was Mizrahi. This was the student that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik loved, him and Rabarach Berlebovitz. He goes and becomes a Rosh Yeshiva at Linus' Yeshiva. He was a complete Mizrahi, through and through, and it needs to be said, he has descendants today living in the land of Israel, completely religious descendants. He was, as I've said before, the first great Torah scholar to come to America, and I think I heard this from Markefet, actually, the first great Torah scholar to come to America, not to raise money, not to do anything else, to come to teach Torah. That was the Mechitzer. Shlomo Palachek. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. Is there another question? One more question. How would people in these tiny towns learn enough Torah to be ready for the yeshivas? Would it depend on a scholar being resident there? Was anyone who's figured it out on his own? You had a rav in the town, and the job of the rabbi was to teach. And remember, you had kids who were in cheder and they were too smart for the melamed. They hired a different person for them. You usually had in these towns people who were talmidei chachamim who were ready to make a few extra dollars by teaching. And when the kid was smart enough, they sent him away to study at one of these little yeshivas before he moved on to the greater yeshivas. If you read the autobiography of Ben Zion Dinor, he was one of these iluyim who at like the age of 11 was sent with his older brother, if I recall, to one of these little yeshivas where he studied there for a couple of years and then he moved on to Tells. And you'd go there and you'd study. I think Yisrael, you're being skeptical, and you shouldn't be, because think of what our kids would be like if from the age of 5, all they did was learn and they didn't have television or sports or anything like that. Now, I'm not talking about the average kid. The average kid wasn't like that at all. But for the kid who's intellectually inclined, if we devoted himself entirely just to learning, by the time he gets to 12, he's going to be quite learned. I'm sure there are people right now listening to us who can tell you about 12-year-olds who know probably 40, 50 daf of Gemara and know it well. I, in my life, have met kids who I think at that age, at 12, 13 years old, are really knowing what I consider to be an enormous amount, because we're talking about kids, even American kids. Every summer they go away, they're learning all summer in camps, and from the age of 10 to 13, you can really learn an enormous, enormous amount if you don't have the distractions, as Baruch says. If you're not playing baseball, now I'm not saying the kids grow up healthy this way. I think we need to give them, but if you take 100 kids and you put them in a barrel, and you squish them around there, and all they do is learn day and night, and in the summer, a Rav Yashav will come out of that. I mean, he's one of these kids who never had any fun, never did anything, just learned. So you're going to get these kids, 100%. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. See you next week, God willing. Bye-bye.